The opinions and views expressed by the guests on this podcast are their sole responsibility and do not necessarily reflect the personal opinion of Letty and or Ash or those who collaborate with Dudas Media.
From the beginning.
Se regalan dudas nace de la infinita necesidad
de cuestionarnos todo.
Todo lo que está a nuestro alrededor.
De dónde venimos y hacia dónde vamos.
Cómo tomar decisiones más informadas.
Tenemos tantas dudas que te las queremos regalar.
Soy Leti Sahagún.
Y yo Ashley Frangé. Y en este espacio invitamos a quienes saben y no saben tanto
de todo eso que tendríamos que estar hablando.
En colaboración
con Acast.
Hey everyone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to another episode of Se Regalan Dudas in English.
Your English is precious, Leticia.
Thank you so much. I'm trying my best.
You're doing great.
You guys know this podcast has been a gift to us since day one. But to me, the most amazing thing it has given me till today is the possibility to talk to some of my favorite people on earth. Most of them didn't know we existed, like you today. But the person that is here today has... We've followed their work for a while now. Every single word that you've put out to the universe has somehow resonated. And I feel so honored and so grateful to have you today here. Because even though I'm sure this is your personal journey, what you've been sharing, it's so amazing how us human connect in such ways. We're from different parts of the world. We probably have such different experiences, and somehow I've cried with your words, I've shared them, and first I just want to say thank you for being here, but also how beautiful it is that we can connect in such ways without you even knowing that me or Ashley ever existed.
I'm so happy that you're here. I remember the first time I saw your face was in a video that you talked about the importance of being who you are and being the trans community, being at the forefront of questioning. And for me, it was like such a connection and bravery. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.
We didn't present you.
Exactly. Today, Leticia, please present our guest.
Today with us is Alok, a beautiful person, activist, writer, poet. I don't know. Sometimes we use words, but they always become short. Out of everything I've ever read from you, I think one of the ideas that has stuck with me throughout time is this idea of how we're constantly becoming as human beings. And I wanted to start my first question there. Like, in your personal journey, how has this idea of constantly becoming played out?
If you zoom into something close enough, everything is shaking and vibrating. One of the many illusions that we have are that things are fixed. And when it comes to our own lives, we'll often notice change on the other side, but not when it's happening. So like 10 years out, we'll be like, I'm a whole new person. But all of those millions of rotations that it took to become that new person, we're not taught how to feel that or express that. So a lot of what I've been trying to do in my life is recalibrate to actually notice what is changing in me and around me. And to welcome that change. I think being able to embrace change is a form of intelligence that we have to learn. Mm-hmm. Because we're often so allergic to change because we're afraid of what we don't know, right? And so I've had to really remind myself change is the fundamental currency of the universe. That's why seasons are important, because what it shows is that nothing is actually permanent. And And one story of that, that's a sad thing, but in another, it's actually a profoundly beautiful thing because that means we get to try again.
What has been, for those that this is the first time meeting you, I would love to understand a little bit about your background and when was that moment where you deciding, I know everyone has so many things to share and we're always saying like we have this platform and we want people to share their stories, but like when did you decide that you wanted to connect through your own story and journey?
I started writing poetry when I was about 12 years old and I would post it online anonymously under a pseudonym. And I found that thing to be true that you were mentioning before, that I could connect with people all across the world who I didn't know. And we were all using pseudonyms, but we felt like closer friends than we had in our own lives because we talked about the things that we weren't allowed to talk about in our real lives, like depression and anxiety and loneliness and pain. I think as a teenager, I wasn't allowed to be a full human. I had to always act gung-ho or excited, or even though I was struggling, I was really struggling, but no one really asked me about that. And so poetry became a portal to strangers who became potential friends. And I realized that actually we all have so much more in common. It's just that on the surface, we pretend like we're so different, but we're all dealing with anxiety, with heartbreak, with grief. And poetry was the first place that I could actually be honest about that and feel like less lonely in those feelings.
Wow. How did you discover that you wanted to not only share your journey and your path, but you also wanted to bring a different narrative than what was accepted? Because I always feel like each of us, no matter our story, there's something that doesn't fit in the accepted narrative. But many times we choose to not see that, just to belong, or just not start a difficult conversation. Because I feel like a part of us knows that if we open up that door, it's going to get messy. It's going to get uncomfortable. It's going to make people uncomfortable. Now I see you and I see you're glowing and you've come to terms with who you are. But I can only imagine that had to be a process. How was that first moment when you realized, like, this narrative that I've been told doesn't work for me? And how did you find the courage to begin a journey when you knew what you were about to talk, what you were about to become, was going to get some backlash and was probably not going to make you feel like you belonged at the beginning, at least? Like, how was that whole journey, if you could walk us through it?
I feel very lucky because I tried what many people do to fit in, to hide myself. And because I was so fabulous, no one really believed me.
Everyone's like,
yeah, let's say like I'm straight, you know, like, I'm just a guy. And then from a very young age, people would call me a pussy or a faggot. And people found out who I was before I did and used slurs. I think slurs were the first way that I could realize I was different. And so I was so afraid of that. I would hide and hide and say, no, no, no. But my body was just too fabulous and it spilled out of those categories. And so I had to really confront who people want me to be is not who I am. Mm-hmm. What do I do with that? And so for the first 18 years of my life, I tried to be what other people wanted me to be. And it left me feeling very suicidal and very depressed. And so I made a childhood promise to myself, the moment that it's safe for me, I'm never going to live a lie again, because I've seen what it's like to live a lie. I feel empty. I feel hollow. I feel dissociated. I think I don't have many memories of my childhood because I was there, but I wasn't there. I was very much separated from myself. It was kind of like Alok was a character that people knew, but not me. And I knew I didn't want to live that hollow life anymore. So I made a promise to myself that coming out was not just about my gender or my sexuality, but my authenticity, my version of me, which meant that I was no longer going to lie. If I didn't like people, I would be like, hey, I don't think this relationship makes sense for us. I would be honest to my parents. I'd be honest to everyone. And it's been, you know, a complicated journey because you begin with that intention and then it gets too scary, so you dial back, and then you go forward and then you dial back. So it's never been linear. But mm-hmm. the lesson that I continue to learn is that honesty is more beautiful and a form of medicine. I think clarity is a form of compassion. So many people are lying to us all the time. And to actually have people in your court who are ruthlessly honest with you, I think is the most beautiful experience for me. And I think we're taught to fear honesty growing up, because if we have to confront, then we're going to have to confront things. But that's how things like patriarchy fester, is we're not honest about gender-based violence. We're not honest about pay inequities. These are just things that are the way that they are. And so a lot of what I'm trying to do in my life is remember that truth, even though it's painful, ultimately is the most rewarding way to show up.
I love that you say about the lies and like the half-truths. I think especially coming from Latin America and like countries like that, that we rather lie than make someone uncomfortable, or we rather like paint the truth a little bit, right? We're like told like, don't say it too harshly. And I think in your work, I found such a, like a little bit like a shaken honesty. And one of the things that we want to talk about your resolutions, and I found them so heartbreaking, honest, like just so upfront. And it's sometimes complicated for me to see the lives we live with such of like a little glass on top. So one of the things that I love the most about your resolution was this idea that you're talking about, to outgrow your own story about yourself. So I wanted to ask you, what have been some parts of your story that you have outgrown, even now as a public figure and that so many people know you? I bet it's even more bigger, maybe, the things that you've grown, but also the challenge of like redirecting, redefining, refocusing.
Such a thoughtful question. Thank you. Giving birth to ourselves is something only we can do. We should be thankful for our parents for bringing us onto this earth, but that's only the beginning. The next is, who do you want to be on your own terms? And I think many people never actually ask that question. They just live the version of themselves that their parents or their society or that their culture has told them that they should be. But they're always going to be resentful, because that's not your choice. And I find that a lot of people don't even have the language to articulate that it's possible to become something else. And that's what I experience often intergenerationally. When I would speak to my grandparents' generation, there'd be so much backlash to what I was doing, because they'd say, "What do you mean we get a choice?" And I'd say, "No, like you get to choose. What do you want to do? Who do you want to be?" And they'd say, no, we can't do that." And so when I'm saying that we have a responsibility to give birth to ourselves, that means that that's not just a one-time event. It's every single day and every single choice we get to decide, am I going to be the highest version of me, or am I going to operate from a lower frequency? So there's some days that I am totally in my power speaking truth, and some days that I'm self-betraying, self-neglecting, self-denying. But the reason I started writing resolutions is I started to realize every year I have a new opportunity to try harder to become someone that I'm proud of, someone who's me on my own terms. So I spent a lot of time writing, thinking, listening to music, reading my diaries from the year before, looking at patterns, saying, what are things I want to break? And what I started to realize in doing that work is I was coasting on a story of myself that was not my highest self. Mm-hmm. So one of those stories was, it's only comfortable for people like me to exist on a stage. Because I think of the history of drag, I felt like the stage was the first place I could express my gender and people would actually congratulate me for it. So I could wear the same things that I was wearing on a train on a stage and people would be like, "That's amazing." But then I started to realize, I want to act. I want to be on TV. I want to exist in other places. But that felt so unfamiliar to me, because I had this narrative of like, oh, that's not for people like me. We only belong here on a stage. And so I had to really realize, oh, that story was implanted on me. Mm-hmm. I get to exist everywhere. But I noticed myself having the shyness, the shame when it came to acting. And I had to realize, oh, that's actually trauma that I have there. I still feel a sense of imposter syndrome. I still feel like it's only safe for me whenever people are clapping for me on a stage, but anywhere else. So I'm really trying to challenge that story. I think another story that I'm growing out of is it's very difficult growing up in the culture that I did to ever do something because it brings you pleasure. Oof. We don't take vacations. We very much like work. You're suffering, work harder. There's never...
You're in pain, yeah, work.
Totally.
And we justify pleasure. Like, yeah, if you ever dare to take a pleasure moment, yeah, you got to justify... No, no, I've been working my ass off this past year. I deserve it.
Yeah. And so the way that that worked for me is I had to justify everything I'm doing as political. Like, mm-hmm, oh, it's political for me to do this. It's important for my community. It's... And I'm like, that's disingenuous. I am the thing that I'm advocating for. And I am allowed to have rest. I'm allowed to have pleasure. I'm allowed to take off time. I'm allowed to do nothing. I'm allowed to do things because they're simple and fun. Mm-hmm. And that's been so hard to rewire for me.
Yeah.
I have my grandmother's voice in the back of my head. I've ever been like,
do not say
no. Like, that's a horrible thing. But what I'm really trying to mature myself into is like, I have to become what I want to see in the world. I can't wait for that. I have to become it. And what I want to see in the world is balance. So it's important to struggle, to work, of course. But I think many of our communities glorify that in a way that's toxic and self-depleting.
And it's also hidden. You know, like all the things we do for pleasure, we like stick it on, like even like sex, but also like food, like everything. It has to be like toned down. Like, how dare you put, like, I totally understand. And I think because the idea of pleasure and guilt have come so mixed around that it's very hard to like separate of like actually just relaxing and having pleasure, any type of pleasure, without the guilt. So I absolutely understand.
So much of my worth as a person was based off of the idea of I'm a hard worker. Mm. Like, other people can relax, but I'm someone who will always give it my all. And now as an adult, I've had to be like, what? That's not cool. I don't aspire to
that. And that's not sustainable. No, like, no. I don't want to be that forever.
No, absolutely not.
I was listening to you saying creating my life on my own terms. And there's nothing I wish more for me and for every person I know and I love in the world than to be able to create that. What I've found is that to be able to create something authentic and in my own terms, more than learning new things, I've had to unlearn a lot of things. And I wanted to see if you could dive further into this, because I felt in my personal journey, and I don't know if people listening right now can relate, but the most scary thing about unlearning is that there's a lot of uncertainty. Like, if I'm not going to stand in what I know, anything is possible. And that could be beautiful sometimes, but it can also be really scary because no one has walked that path, because I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what to stand for anymore. I don't know who I am. How did you deal with, and how do you deal, because I know unlearning is not linear, with the fear of uncertainty while you're unlearning? Because then you got to come up with new ideas that probably no one has ever seen, heard, or lived before.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
A lot of people look at me as someone who's courageous and doesn't have fear, but I of course still have fear. But what I'm trying to do is not allow fear to dictate how I show up in the world. So I've learned rituals on how to deal with fear. So when fear blooms up inside of me, instead of trying to reject it or hide it or shame it, I greet it. I say, hi, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here. I love you. And what happens when we love fear is it loses its stranglehold on us. Because what fear often is our childhood voice, or our parental voice, or someone else that's trying to protect us. And so that's a really noble intention. Like, I need to be protected. Thank you for doing that. It's just that this form of protection is not actually what I need. So when I'm able to say I love you to fear, then I can sort of say, I'm afraid that you're not going to be safe. And then I can come in and say, no, actually, I am going to be safe. I've built this foundation for myself. I believe in me. And then I keep fear as a companion. So what I understand courage to be is not actually about eliminating fear, because that's, I'm not interested.
Impossible.
In, impossible. But in integrating and incorporating it. So I can be both courageous and fearful at the same time. I can be both incredibly scared and incredibly confident at the same time.
I wanted to ask you about another thing I read on your resolutions that is so, it felt so, I felt so seen. That was, everything deserves a funeral. And I think in the world we live in, we're supposed to move on to things so quickly. You were talking about change, and I told you, I was like, I hate change. For me, it's so difficult to change everything, to change whatever decision, because my heart needs to have a funeral for absolutely everything. And I think I was taught at a very young age that grief wasn't something that you're allowed to extend. You go to the funeral of whoever died, you go, you let go of that relationship, and you're supposed to move on. So I wanted to talk about that, the idea of giving grief a lot of space.
Grief is the oldest new friend and the newest old friend. Just when we feel like we know grief, grief actually proves us that we don't. Every time I lose something in my life, I think, okay, I'm going to be prepared for the next time. And then the next time is just as destabilizing. So I understand why people have built entire cultures that numb themselves to pain, because they're so afraid of that. And I can tell immediately who are the people who are doing grief work and who are not. Because when you walk into a room crying because you're missing someone, it's almost as if it's a magnetizing force for the people who are ready and a repellent for people who have not done their own emotional work.
That is so true.
Right? You know? And so my astrological sign is Cancer, so I feel things extremely deeply. So when I'm sad, I'm very sad. So I've built a community of people who can be non-judgmental of my sadness, who allow me my process and journey. I didn't have that growing up. And that's why I feel like friendships are places, laboratories even, where we can experiment with different ways to relate to each other than what our families of origin did. So often when I would express an emotion growing up, it would make everyone very uncomfortable. So then I'd be like, okay, and I'd apologize. So it'd be like sadness, apology. Like I was distracting from something. But now I've had friends who are like, sadness, awesome. Thank you for feeling that. I feel the same way too. So I'm trying to retrain my brain. But with that resolution, when I'm saying everything deserves a funeral, what I mean is, if we do not actually have a ritual to acknowledge that change has occurred, that things will never be the same again, we hold on to that pain, and it becomes resentment, bitterness, anger, and oftentimes violence. Mm-hmm. So my belief is that the majority of violence in the world comes from unprocessed pain. So the only reason people can be so harmful and ruthless to other people is because they're all trying to avoid their pain. And so it's much more complicated, difficult work to confront your own pain than it is to judge or persecute other people. So I believe, especially when it comes to transgender issues, that what's happening is that all of the murkiness of non-trans people's inability to fit into those gender categories themselves, it's outsourced onto us. So instead of saying, I don't really fit into that definition of woman either, or I'm not this machismo man either, you judge us so that you can distract away from having to reconcile that in your own self.
I love that you say that, and also what you said about friends. And I wanted to just pause there, because friends have been the light of my life. I mean, Letty and I have had a 20-year-old friendship. How have you become a better friend?
My friends are my lovers. I don't practice a relationship model that sees romantic love as more than friendship love.
I love that. Wow.
So for me, I treat my friends like people would treat their romantic partners. We're going out on dates. We're taking vacations together. We're making life plans together. We're sharing resources. And what that's meant for me is that I never have to fear being alone. Because I genuinely have so many people who I've distributed intimacy with. So even if one friend is unavailable, I'm building with someone else. or if one friend is in a really intense, committed romantic partnership and he can't be there for a while, I'm with someone else. And I think I learned that growing up when I was closeted and struggling from, I felt like, okay, I'm going to have to be alone for the rest of my life. So I need to learn how to make friends with people. And that's a skill actually that I've learned. And the reason I bring that up is because oftentimes the only narrative we have about growing up as an LGBTQ person is one of bullying and discrimination. But I think alongside that, there's also a lot of genius. Because I had so much fear, I had to figure out what to do with that fear, and friendship was where I went with that. So from a young age, I learned how to have deep, emotional, vulnerable conversations immediately. I learned how to come up to someone and say, hey, I'm really struggling, are you? And build meaningful relationships. I learned the importance of following up. In New York City, a lot of people will say, let's have lunch, and then never do that. But I came in when I moved to New York saying, I'm here to make real friendships. I'm going to follow up. I'm going to invite you over. I'm going to try to cook for you. I'm not very good at it, but I'm going to try. I'm going to try to be that kind of person because I understood the stakes of it. Mm-hmm. I understood what it feels like to have no one. And I never wanted to have any. I never wanted to be in that position again.
I love that. Beautiful. Thank you.
That is so beautiful. The friendship thing I'm going to take for the rest, because that's how I feel about most of my friends, but maybe like what we've talked, since I've never seen someone place their friendships in such a high place, I always think they might not
be occupy, there forever.
No, or you prioritize at times a romantic relationship, thinking that is the goal in life, to share forever a romantic partner. Why is it not to share forever my closest friendships? Like, why can't that also be permanent?
Absolutely. My goal in life is to have a dignified death. And part of what having a dignified death is imagining when I die, I want my entire hospital room, God willing, there'll be one, to be surrounded by people who love me. And the idea of just reserving that for one person seems so ludicrous.
So, and so yeah. Like probabilities are very low. Very that person low. Won't be there.
Very low. Whereas if you're investing in a lot of people, chances are you're going to have at least 5-6 people show up in that moment. Because I've been there. I've been that person on the other side of someone else passing. That is the scariest moment ever, where you are having to hear death knock and you can have comfort in the room. That's the most meaningful thing. And so I feel so lucky to have been that for other people. I want to live a life where I don't shy away from death. Where I actually really think, is this aligned with me having a dignified death? And I think we live in a culture, which name it a Western colonial culture, that is afraid of talking about death.
Yeah.
But actually many, when we look, many indigenous cultures across the world have much more frank conversations about death.
Yeah.
I think what's naive is that we don't speak about death enough.
We're all going to die.
We're all going to die.
Everyone's going to die. It's insane. Yeah.
Now that we're talking about friends, I just wanted to also ask, I think for a lot of people in the queer LGBTQ plus community, it's very tough to understand that the people that you grew up with, or sometimes family, or the people that surround yourself are the ones that hurt you the most, or that can't see you, or can't accept who you truly are. And I heard an interview you once telling the story of how your grandma, with a lot of love, was telling you not to get a piercing. Right. And how you were able to turn the conversation around. And then, so I wanted to understand what you found outside of family, for example, and how important was that in your own path, but also how you've been able to shine love into people that have not showed you that. Because I not only saw that in the conversation you had with your grandma, but I see that through social media. And that's what amazes me the most. Every time you get the most hateful, hurtful things that if I were reading them, or when I'm reading them, I'm like, who could possibly put this even into words and into a text? You somehow turn it around and shine love to that. So I wanted to understand how you're able to turn something around.
One of the most important romantic relationships we can have is our relationship with ourselves. And we live in a culture that is so invested in our ideal partner. But what about our ideal self? And so I started to really work on loving me, which is extremely difficult work because I am often the cruelest person to myself, the meanest, the most ruthless. I can do an amazing job and go home and nitpick after this interview. I can be in the car thinking, I didn't articulate myself in this way. I just beat myself up over and over again. So I've been really trying to practice self-forgiveness, self-compassion. And the more that I am able to have compassion for myself, the more that I realize I'm just human. I can't be this perfect thing. I'm just human, and that's enough. Once I become intimate with my own humanity, I see other people's humanity. Mm. If I'm just human, if I'm making these mistakes from a real place, they are too. Mm-hmm. So as I've become more in touch with my humanity, I've seen other people's humanity. And I've seen, oh, wait, the most human thing is people lying to be loved. The most human thing is people self-sabotaging because they're afraid. The most human thing is people shape-shifting in order to make other people feel comfortable. All these things that people did to me were things that they did because they had this limiting belief system that they couldn't be loved for who they were. So it actually doesn't have anything to do with me. I'm just caught in the crossfires of their internal self-hatred. So once I started to realize that, I started to recognize the way to change people is not to judge them, is not to shame them, but is to say, I love you so much, I'm rooting in your transformation, because that's how I changed myself. So a lot of people think of compassion as passive, as resigned, right. And they were like, well, you have to fight back. Compassion is a form of fighting back. And compassion is a form of fighting back that works. Because what's ridiculous to me right now is people keep on believing that war can stop war, that violence can stop violence, that aggression can stop aggression. It's never...
The oldest joke.
Never worked. So why not try something different? And my leaders, the people who I think about most compassion from, are often the people who have been shown the least amount of compassion. And I think that's an interesting scenario where those of us who are often so profoundly mistreated in the world, we begin to actually recognize the importance of a thing like kindness, because when we're shown that kindness, it feels like earth-shattering, life-giving. So I want to give that back because I know how precious kindness has felt in my life.
I admire you so much because it's so easy to take the other route. You know, the old joke of like war won't solve. There's this saying in Spanish, ojo por ojo, which is one eye for another eye, you know? And to choose the other route takes discipline as well to like say, like, I'm choosing compassion today as a form of everything, the way I talk, the way I walk and everything. I wanted to ask you, one of the things that I love the most in the world is language, right? Languages, written words, everything. There are so many words we get to pick to say so many things, right? And I have found that my words that come out of my mouth can either build beautiful bridges or can just burn it all to the ground. And I love about your work is you're so intentional with words. And I think it's a resource that everyone has available, but sometimes we're so limited in the way we use it. And I wanted to ask you, what has a part of being a poet and like using language as your form of work, but in your day-to-day relationships, how do you choose and how do you bring conscious language to everything you do?
It's interesting you bring that up because I just gave a speech that I was telling you about, and it's about the importance of language. And what I say in the speech is I went to an orthodontist who told me that I needed speaking lessons because every time I talk, my tongue graces my front teeth and it's pushing them slowly. And I started to actually say, that's exactly what I believe language should do. Move us, like physically push us. And so I said, like, thank you to my orthodontist for reminding me the power of speech. And what I was saying in my speech is, I think people no longer mean what they say. And so much of what we have right now is a crisis of empty words. It's people saying, I love you, but not actually meaning that. It's people saying human rights, but not actually meaning that. And so what's confusing is we have more words and less truth than ever. So what I'm trying to do is only speak the truth, only use words that I actually believe. many people use words because they want to make people happy, they want to make people comfortable, because they think people need them to speak. But actually, the work of speaking begins with silence. Should I be speaking right now? Like, am I really the best to be speaking right now? How do I articulate this? So I've been spending a lot more time in silence. I've been spending a lot more time reading, a lot more time reflecting, writing before I speak, because I now understand how precious words are. And yes, it's my job, so I pay attention to it. But what it also allows me to see is, like, oftentimes words are dismissed in our culture as immaterial, as just something that's happening on the surface. But people remember the words the most. When you think about a fight with a partner, they'll say, when you said...
Sentence you said.
There are some phrases that are stuck in our heads forever. There is a concept, I think, that you explained. And I have it here, but I don't even want to read it because I'd rather you explain it to us, which is why we must have the courage to break our own hearts. Can you explain a bit further? Because this is one of my favorite things I've ever read. And I have it on my mirror just as a reminder every day of, like, what we thought kept us safe didn't. Like, I keep telling myself that over and over.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
If we don't break our hearts, it's going to be 10 times more painful when the world keeps on doing it to us. So the truth is, a lot of us make decisions from information that's 10 years old.
Yeah.
So when it came to me, a lot of the fundamental decisions I made about my career, about who I wanted to be, was when I was 13.
Yeah.
And I never checked in to be like, okay, I have...
We're sure like this.
Yeah. I have so much more data now. So I used to think safety came from not speaking up, from remaining silent. But then on the other side, I realized, no, it doesn't. And that was profoundly sad to me to realize that, because it felt like, oh, I wasted so much of my life on this false narrative. So that's what compassionate heartbreak is actually sitting in that grief of being like, all these versions of me, all these decisions I made, they weren't right. But then the grace comes in, because when you admit that they weren't right, then you get to restart. But in order for us to restart, we have to feel the pain and the grief and the disappointment of all the things that we thought were fixed that were not. It's that process of unlearning you were speaking to. And my diagnosis of what's happening right now is many people are just staying in that past version of themselves, defending that narrative. This is what it is. This is what it is. Against all other evidence. Because to really feel that pain, because the reason it's painful is, where did that come from? It came from people who said that they loved us. It came from mom and dad. It came from religion. It came from schools. It came from people we looked up to.
Yeah.
And so if we have to admit that those people might have been lying, that destroys our entire worldview. But here's the truth about destruction. It can be another form of creation. And that's what's beautiful for me about being non-binary, is it's allowed me to realize the duality of everything. Destruction is creation. Life is another form of death. Death is another form of life. Sorrow is a form of joy. Joy is a form of sorrow. All of these things that get positioned as opposites can actually be held at the same time. And that's what healing is being able to hold things simultaneously.
And in this new creation, everything is possible. And what I love about that is, if instead of tapping into who am I or I don't understand anything any longer, we tap into, if you use your imagination and your own instinct, anything you want to create is possible. That means we don't have to fit ourselves into any type of box, any type of label, any type of definition. It's just a beautiful thing to, not only, like you said, every year a new possibility, but every day a new possibility, not just for the world, for myself. There's one thing that I want to see if we can talk about before we finish the episode, and it's about...
I have like 10 questions.
I know, it's never ending. But
DC, I have 10 questions.
And I think this speaks to any human that is on the planet right now, and it's the need for external validation. And the beauty standards that we were pursuing and were pushed into. And I want to understand, how have you been able to transform that journey of external validation to an internal journey of love? Because then no matter what you do, the outside factors have no say.
Look, external validation is important, but it shouldn't come from a stranger on the street. It shouldn't come from some beauty influencer you don't even know. External validation should come from someone who really loves you and knows you. So when my friends say, hey, I'm proud of the show you just made, I'm like, wow, that means something to me. I really respect you. You are someone who cares about me. But when someone in my comment section is like, shave, you have no idea who I am, you know? So I'm not saying external validation is bad. I think it can be beautiful to validate one another, but I want that to come from people who actually care about us, not people who don't know us. But I think part of your question is how you develop the internal resiliency to have your own frame of reference, your own criteria, rather than contouring yourself for someone else.
Exactly.
That's really difficult work that only can be done through a practice of isolation or contemplation. You have to separate from yourself, from the world. I'm lucky because that's what my writing practice is. I can't write when I'm with other people, the noise, the distractions. So I have to separate myself. So most of the writing I do is never to be published, never for other people. It's just, what do I feel? What do I feel about what just happened? I just had this thing happen to me. Let me write about it. How are we supposed to know what we actually feel without sitting and thinking about it? With our busyness and our days, often people never take the time to actually sit and be alone and think about something. But the more that I started to write, the more I started to think, I developed a self-concept outside of other people. And that's the most beautiful version of me. It's not what I look like. It's a feeling of being like, I like me. I'll be writing being like, I like me. I like what I'm saying. I'm in dialogue with myself, and this person I'm becoming is someone I'm really proud of. So it was by spending intentional time with myself that I developed a self-concept where I could say, oh, okay, it might seem tempting to get validation from here, but this kind of validation, it's more nourishing, it's more permanent. That kind of validation, it expires very quickly.
What have you done with this idea that someone is going to come and save you? I think it's something that has been helpful for a lot of us that had complex childhoods, but as you become an adult, does no longer serve you. And that crushing of that myth that literally no one is coming to save you. I mean, there's people that believe in religion, but really on the day to day, no one's going to come to save you, has been one of the things that has broken more my heart, right? The idea that I am responsible for the life I was given to its fullest, and that I really wish someone can come and save me from a lot of things that I'm going through. But people can come and hang out with me, but I'm the only one. How have you, or where do you sit that idea of no one is coming to save me in this world?
It sucks because it's so easy to believe in that fiction. It's so much harder to actually develop the skills, the emotional skills, to be able to care for ourselves. I think growing up, I also similarly had that narrative. And the way that it looked for me is like, it wasn't even just a person. It was, I'm going to land this one gig. I'm going to get this one degree. I'm going to have this thing. And then everything's going to be gone. Because often the narrative we're taught under meritocracy is if you just reach a certain point in the ladder, it'll all go away. And that's just not true. I'm doing things I never thought were possible, and I'm still experiencing transphobia. This idea that we can somehow escape or leapfrog out of a situation is fundamentally flawed because it should never have been up to us. The society needs to change, not us. The only way that I'm going to no longer have to fear for my life is not if I'm successful, if people remember their own humanity. So it's not actually about me. So I think the first step is to really have to reckon that this is about societal cultural failing, not about individual one. Then I think the next piece is notice the parts that you want to be rescued for and start learning specific activities to make you feel powerful in those places. So for me, a lot of it was street violence. I was super afraid. If I present as myself in public, people are going to physically attack me. If I find some nice burly male partner, he's going to defend me. Tell me why every guy that I dated who was burly was literally the most afraid.
It's like, no.
It's been like women who have defended me from street harassment the most will be like, get, you know, it's never been guy. They're often the most afraid, most fragile. So then I started to exercise to actually be like, I want to feel physically powerful. I want to have a relationship with my body that's not just about fear, but actually about strength. And so that was my motivation to start my fitness journey so that I could feel physically powerful in myself. And that's been so awesome.
Wow.
So it's about learning things that you feel fear about or that you feel like you need rescue and developing skills to actually become that person.
I love that.
Yeah.
One more question. How do you remain brave and hopeful and showing up in a society that is going through, we're looking at genocide occurring. We are looking at so many trans rights being, it feels like a little bit backwards. So many women rights and abortion rights, all that has been challenged. How do you show up, keep showing up? I know there's a part of you that is your work and that you do it as a job. Like, how are you showing up in your personal life in a world that sometimes feels so, of course, scary, but so not worthy of showing up sometimes?
Because in that awful world, I found you, someone who I didn't know, but I know. And that keeps happening. I meet incredible people who care and feel and love. So part of that duality piece is, yes, of course, there's catastrophe occurring. But alongside that, there's remarkable community. And I have to lean into that. Mm-hmm. I have to remember that love is so powerful that there are going to be miraculous moments of connection and places that feel desolate and impossible. One of the best parts about being a touring artist is I get to go to every nook and cranny of the earth and meet people who I can become best friends with. And so therefore, every ideology that has taught me, oh, you can't trust those people of this religion, that gender, this region, falls apart.
Yeah.
When you meet people up close and you're like, we're human. So what gives me hope is our humanity, is being able to meet other humans and be like, oh, we're all in this together. And I lean into that.
Yeah, there's one of the biggest women Mexican activists came to the podcast. And she, before leaving the episode, she said, I just want to remind you that the newspapers and everything we hear might be taken by these two or three terrible things that happen, but it's most of us that are humans that have good intentions, that actually want to change, that actually, like, don't think that that represents most of humanity, because then we've all lost. And she says throughout her 20 years of work, she's found that everyone is willing to help, to change, to, and there's only two or three, you know, bad people here, or not bad people, but just people making the wrong decisions here and there. But she was like, no, it's most of us that actually want things to change. Now that you were talking about touring, I know you have this comedy tour. I want to hear where are you going? Where can we see you? Also, if you could tell us about that beautiful Netflix special with Hannah Gatsby, would love to hear more about that too.
Yeah, sure. So I've been touring a show for the past 2 years in over 40 countries. I was just in Mexico City and Guadalajara in July.
That's where we're from?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we're from Guadalajara.
It was my first Latin American tour. So I also did.
I wish I met you before so I can give you all the good food. Oh, my. Place.
I did eat some amazing food, but I'm sure you might
know. We were
know
just
some...
named one of the best, the number one city to eat in the world.
Wow.
Sorry. In Latin America, sorry.
So I was in Buenos Aires. I was in Bogota. I was in Santiago de Chile. I was all over. And it was my first time in Latin America performing. The audiences were so amazing.
Yeah.
Responsive, emotional, energetic, passionate. And queer movements across Latin America are so incredible. I learned so much. I can't
They're
wait to come back.
They're organized as fuck.
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
So it's just incredible to be able to tour, because I think a lot of comics in the U.S. just tour in the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's never been my priority. I love touring across Africa, across Asia, across Latin America, and actually saying art can unify us. Sometimes I'll have interpreters just giggling as they're translating in Spanish, and that's my favorite part. So nice. In terms of where you can catch me, I'm writing a new show right now that's going to debut at the Netflix Comedy Festival in May here in Los Angeles. And I will also be on a Netflix comedy special with Hannah Gatsby that's coming out on March 5th on Netflix globally. What's exciting is it's the first ever all-trans lineup of comics.
Yes.
So we needed it, because so often there's so much bad jokes about us and we never get any ability to respond. So this is our response.
Yeah, and I was just asking you, because also you had the short documentary in Sundance. And I want to know, how was it having someone follow you around for so many months, but also seeing you, like, sitting down and actually seeing the short film of yourself?
Yeah. My friend Alex, who's the director, just was like, hey, I want to come with you on tour. So they came with me to South Africa, Namibia, across the U.S. And I felt both horrified, because I'm so often self-conscious about my image, still working on it. So I'd be like, really, don't photograph me when I'm in these pajamas. But the purpose of documentary film is to show that 360, who we are behind the scenes. So I leaned into that. But I think what I ultimately found so compelling about it is that Alex was able to interview my friends across the world. And finally, the world get to see the people who I love so much, who inspire me so much. So what's beautiful is it's a documentary called Alok, but it has interviews with all my friends. And I think that's a poetic metaphor of, like, who I am is the byproduct of all these powerful friendships.
Yeah. How do we explain ourselves without the people that surround us? Like, it's like me telling my story without you being involved, you know?
No, like, and also, like, this idea that we, what you said, like, it is so important to be validated and seen by the people you love. Like, we literally... That saying that's so old, but like, you, no man is an island, is true. Like, no one, we are who we surround ourselves with. Thank you so much for coming. It was such an honor to have you here. Literally, it is so beautiful to get this opportunity to interview you, but also to meet you. I feel very honored. Thank you.
Same. And I just want to say, yeah, we follow your work. I've bought, like, your books, everything, but those resolutions stick with me forever and ever, because they're so short, but they're so...
Pack just, a bunch.
Oh, my God. Yeah, thank you so much, Alok. Know that Se Regalan Dudas will always be your home whenever you want to show up. And next time you go to Mexico, please let us know.
We will leave all your info in our newsletter so that everyone that is listening to us can follow you, can look at your documentary, come see you to the Netflix comedy show. And we'll see you guys Thursday or
Tuesday.
Tuesday or Thursday. Sorry.
Yeah, and know that all the resources are always in the link that you find here in the episode, in case you're wondering where to find all of this valuable information.
Thank you.
Bye.
Join Connor Connor where the big boys play.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.